His name is Alan Reed Francis Xavier McGee. Come on, come on. Thank you. And I am an alcoholic. That's what you were waiting for. Anything I say up here can be held against me, but not against AA. There's only two groups in AA that I like to stress that to: newcomers and old-timers. And if we all remember it, then nothing I say up here, nor any other speaker from any other AA podium, anytime, anywhere, need ever distress you, nor bug you. As a matter of fact, there's always a great possibility that something that is said might help you, as well as the one who says it. Please God, that will be the way it is tonight. I'm always a little irritated and disenchanted with speakers from AA podiums who begin by telling you how nervous they are. It always sounds like special pleading to me. That's kind of the saying, look, I'm shy and I'm sensitive and I'm fragile, so cooperate. Well, I'm nervous tonight. Darn nervous. But it isn't at all because I'm shy or sensitive or fragile. I wouldn't be here if I was shy and sensitive and fragile. I'm about as shy as a bull. Why I am nervous is a thought that keeps, it's a question really, that keeps recurring in my mind over the years. I think it probably first hit my brain when I was about a week old and on my way to St. Joseph's Church in Krebs, Oklahoma to be baptized. And the question is, I wonder what kind of an impression I'll make. And that is why I'm nervous. I have a problem in that I have now been sober longer than I drank. And as the years go by, and I'm asked to speak at AA meetings, I quickly review these 19 years in my mind, and I think, well, dear God, what will I talk about? Because, obviously, when you've been sober for 19 years, more than 19 years, you can pile up an awful lot of experience, that important thing that we're supposed to share. And the magnificent thing about this experience that we pile up in AA is that we remember it. And because we remember it, we learn from it. And because we have learned from it, there is the natural wish to want to pass it on to those who are following us. As a matter of fact, that is really, in my opinion, what the AA Fellowship is all about. And since, of course, this has happened to me, and I have lived this experience and learned it, it is of intense importance to me, and I don't see how I can leave out one tiny little word of it. But in case you think that you are going to be subjected to 19 years, take heart. I'm just simply not strong enough to stand up here that long. Am I too close? It sounds horrible to me.
I think that'll do it.
All right. So, what I'm left with is to try to, in any one of these 19 years now, I can get off and give a 2 or 3 hour dissertation on any one of these years, and they're very good dissertations, I'll tell you. Believe you me, these 19 years have been quite eventful. And, but I'll try tonight to telescope it, because if I am to share with you, then that's what really it is, how it all came together, how it finally all came together, and what brings me to this moment here tonight. And it's not going to be easy to do, but I'll try. It's never easy to be rigorously honest about yourself. It's so pleasant to be rigorously honest about everything else. But about yourself is a little tough. So since I have been sober now longer than I drank, thank God I can spare you from any drunk log. As a matter of fact, my drinking is just exactly like your drinking. The longer I'm in AA, the more distressed I am that nobody comes up with any new thing, really. We all drank too much, too fast, too long. As a matter of fact, my drinking can be find a parallel in the old story about the bobcat who mistakenly courted the skunk and was later heard to remark, "Well, I enjoyed as much of it as I could stand." And in one sentence, that takes care of my 19 years of drinking. I stayed in there as long as I could. And I didn't, quote, surrender easily. I don't think anybody ever approached this fellowship with more of a closed mind than I did. As a matter of fact, I got here while headed in exactly the opposite direction. It was my intention to take what was left of my substance and go down to Skid Row. And there, among my people, in my days anonymously, a misunderstood genius to the very last. And I can't at all, I don't dare get off on telling you how I got to AA, because it is a fascinating story. I regale people with it for hours. And if I dare start, we just won't get from there. But due to an unholy alliance that developed between my boss, my pastor, my physician, the one friend I had left, and two Irish conspirators from AA by the name of Sullivan and Regan, instead of finding myself in the anonymity of Skid Row, I found myself in the somewhat belligerent anonymity of Alcoholics Anonymous, an environment to which I took an instant and violent dislike, among people I decided were definitely not my people. But I was trapped. Totally and completely trapped. When everyone who has anything at all to do with you, including one of God's direct representatives, has decided that for you, a sojourn in a land called AA is highly to be desired, then anyone who was feeling as weak and weary and guilty as I was is not likely to give any visible signs of rebellion. So I went to AA after this 12-step call that was paid on me by these two Irish 12-steppers. It was a very spiritual 12-step call. They came into the apartment, took one look at me, and said, "Do you have any money?" And I said, "Well, wouldn't you know? Yes, I have money. Why do you ask?" They said, "Well, to our practiced eye, you're about 5 minutes away from the DTs, and we think you should be placed in a sanitarium." And I said, "Well, can I choose a sanitarium? With some of them I have credit." And they said, "Yes, you can choose the sanitarium." So I asked to be taken to one that I had come to be my favorite. I had found it after much research. It was located on Fairfax Avenue in West Hollywood, just two blocks away from my parish church. And I figured that if I worked everything all right and God was kind, I would be in Dr. Maidman's sanitarium. He would come in with a shot of formaldehyde while Father O'Toole came in with the last rites, and it would all come out even. So So it was from this spiritual background that I approached my first AA meeting. I have heard many speakers and AA podiums since say that it was all those happy people at the first AA meeting that won them over. Well, this was a large meeting. It was on a Saturday night on Hollywood Boulevard, the basement of the Garden Court Apartments, just opposite the Cinegrill on the Hollywood Roosevelt. That is a watering hole that you Northerners would not know anything about, I think. But besides alcohol, you found other divertissements there. And I remember as I walked down the stairs of this basement entrance, I remember looking across Hollywood Boulevard at the Cinegrill and thinking, well, goodbye. It's all over. I'm going off to this place where everybody thinks I ought to be, and it'll be just my luck for it to work. I may become healthy, probably a little sane, maybe even a little rich, but I will be dead because I'm going to be sober the rest of my natural life, and I couldn't contemplate it. However, as I said, there wasn't any way that I could get out of it. I looked at these happy people, I listened to them, and I wanted to go outside and vomit. I said to myself, if they're really this happy, they are morons. They simply don't know that I and the world are coming unglued. And they're sitting in here laughing and using little code words on each other. I knew they were code words because they lifted their eyebrows when they talked to each other. One would come up to the other one and say, hi. First things first. And the other one would say, yep, and easy does it. And then they would part, having exchanged worlds of information. I also was sure that they were all stockholders in foreign coffee plantations. I knew of no other reason that it could explain why they drank gallons of this beverage that they call coffee. And over the years, I have looked at this habit that we have. I've seen newcomers come in shaking, sweating, don't know whether to run to the toilet or sit down. And we say, have a cup of coffee. 3 weeks later, the poor devil comes in, his eyes are like these, he says, when will I sleep? And we say, don't worry, nobody ever died of insomnia, have a cup of coffee. I don't think it will ever change. Talk about getting sober in spite of. But I was trapped. And so I did what I always did in those days when I found myself with my back up against the wall and in a situation that was not to my liking, I adapted. And the way that I adapted was always the same. I sincerely pretended. And looking around at my new surroundings, I knew that this technique was going to pay off better here than it ever had anywhere else. It is believed that in Alcoholics Anonymous, in our humility and in our anonymity, that we have reached a milestone in this highly to be desired virtue of humility. But I was born and reared in a religion that is the ultimate in anonymity and in humility. You can run up the aisle to the communion rail until you wear out the carpet. And no one pays the slightest bit of attention. You can run in and out of the confessional like a whirling dervish. And no one bothers to notice unless perhaps you stay a little longer than usual And then there is some conjecture as to what new sin you may have come up with. Your virtue is known only to God and to you. And this doesn't get you very much publicity. But oh, how different is the practice of the virtue of sobriety and humility in Alcoholics Anonymous. No wonder it held such fascination for me. From the moment you hold up your reluctant hand as a newcomer, you are greeted by the moist and welcoming eyes of your neighbors. Utter strangers rush up to grab your hand and know your name. And no matter how vacantly you may stare back, you are assured over and over that you are in the right place. Your head fairly swims with the knowledge that you are everybody's life's blood. Your every word and movement is given loving attention. Even something as simple as sitting up straight in your chair is taken as unmistakable evidence that you are growing. When it is discovered that you can put two sentences together without having them collide, you are asked to speak. And to a Catholic who has been living in the lifelong anonymity of the church, this is akin to suddenly being asked to say Mass. I was so delighted with the attention I was getting that pretty soon I completely forgot how much I disliked the people who were giving it to me. I began to think to myself, I wonder how they got along for so long before I came along. And of course, I thought they were totally, terribly brief and young. After all, you know, those of you who may not know this, we Catholics humbly believe we are the one, the only, and the true. And to someone who has been weaned on 2,000 years of St. Paul, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. John of the Cross, and a few cats like that, you know, something that happened 15 years ago in Akron, when I came, Akron, between a broken-down stockbroker and a defunct doctor, doesn't hold out much promise. But I went along. It was all so simple. I read the book, and I thought, well, it's not very well written, but it's sound. And I developed a little AA smile. You've seen it. Matter of fact, I thought I detected it a couple of times today here. It's that little half smile that says, I'm all right. Just don't get too close. And I grew. I'd been sober about 2 weeks when, with that acute hearing that alcoholics developed, I was at a meeting and there were two men about 50 feet away carrying on a conversation, and I heard one of them say, have you noticed that new guy McGinnis? And I didn't even have to turn. I said, you know, he's only been sober a couple of weeks, but have you noticed how he's growing? After that, any time anybody looked at me, I grew right in front of their eyes. Fortunately, I'm a very quick study. Just about 3 months passed when it dawned on me that the fascination I had been exuding apparently upon people as a newcomer had begun to fade. The people I was bumping into at meetings were not immediately healed of their disease. As a matter of fact, they started asking me not to bump into them. And then I made even a more shattering discovery. And that was that you can sin much more efficiently sober than you can drunk. and to an Irish Catholic who has depended for years upon booze to get him through sin, this can be completely and totally demoralizing. I, after all this 3 months, because I, when I came in to AA, and as I said, 15 minutes after my first meeting, I knew I was back in the Be a Better Person business. And I had always failed in this business, but I thought, well, we'll try it again here. At the sanitarium where I had been, or as I started my career in AA, that, as I said, my pastor, my boss, my priest, my doctor, my friend, and these two AA missionaries had kept coming, and every time I tried to say anything, they say, don't worry now, you're going to AA, and they know that the way you act is not your fault. They know that you're sick, and it will all be different. And of course, after 15 minutes after I came into AA, I thought, my God, you know, I came in here carrying the Ten Commandments and the six precepts of the church on my back, and now they've given me 12 more steps, which I need like I need a hole in the head. But if this is what I've got to do, I'll do it. And I had made this shattering discovery that here I was, and after all this 3 months of the pursuit of sanctity, all these 12-step calls, the meetings, the smile, the code words, the coffee, the slobbering drunks, I was the same SOB that I had always been, except I was sober. And I had been robbed of my alibi. Because for years, I had been looking up to God, priests, bosses, judges, policemen, bartenders. I was nearly always flat on my ass, so I was nearly always looking up. Saying, well, you know, I never would have done it if I hadn't been drunk. And now I was doing it, and doing it better, because I was doing it sober. And I couldn't take this knowledge. I just couldn't, I couldn't accept it. Because once again, the pursuit of the virtue of sobriety had failed me. So I uttered the fateful words, that the most fateful words, and notice I say fateful, not fatal. They're fatal depending upon how you answer them. But the most fateful words an alcoholic can ever say, and that is, what is the point of sobriety if? And what I said to myself was, what is the point of sobriety if I don't become a better person? And since I said them, didn't say them out loud, no one answered me. And so I resigned. In the next 2.5 months that followed, I tried committing suicide in the only way that seems to be acceptable to Catholics. I tried drinking myself to death. And I made a very useful discovery about this disease. In case you would like to know, I'll pass it on to you. You don't die fast. Instead of waking up dead, you just keep waking up day after day, week after week, just wishing you were dead. But somewhere in those 2.5 months, I began to come to grips with what has to be. I wouldn't be here tonight. There wouldn't have been the 19 years that followed if I hadn't come to grips with what was for me this first thing first. And that is, am I really an alcoholic? And if the answer to that is yes, then do I really believe that alcoholism is truly a progressive and a fatal disease? Or do I believe that it's the moral weakness that I always was taught it was? And that even today in our culture, we are taught this. Before I got to AA and after I got to AA, sobriety was a means to an end. It was something you did in order to get something else. Before I got to AA and the culture that shaped and molded me, drunkenness was a mortal sin. So therefore, its absence, sobriety, must necessarily be a shining virtue. As a matter of fact, in the culture from which I came, it was just a notch below chastity. So when you have assumed that you are practicing the virtue of sobriety, as it follows then that since it's a virtue, you will have to be virtuous in order to achieve and maintain it. And if, through very great prayer and effort, you manage to achieve this shining virtue of sobriety, doesn't it also follow as the ninth the day that you should, by God, get a reward for it? You're damn right you should get a reward for it. And that's the way I came into AA, and I think that's the way everybody's coming in behind me all these years. And until you get that straightened out in your mind, I don't think that any true recovery from alcoholism ever really begins, no matter how long you're staying sober. If you're staying sober in order to get something, or to get it back, the day will always come when what you have been staying to get sober to get back, you either will have not gotten it back, or now that you have gotten it, you will no longer want it. And so then you will say the fateful words, what's the point of sobriety if, it may not be with you, what's the point of sobriety if I don't become a better person? But you might very well be, because even in AA, you see, we seem to talk out of both sides of our mouth at once. On the one hand, we tell you that there is no moral culpability with this in connection with this disease at all. But then it seems in the same breath, we then hasten to tell you that you're going to have a complete and total change of personality. You're going to have a spiritual awakening. You're going to have to find a power greater than yourself and all these things in order to stay sober. And AA reverberates with phrases like, don't do that or you will get drunk. So we add fear upon fear upon fear. Remember, I started this out, ladies and gentlemen, by telling you that anything I say can be held against me. So while you are reacting to this, just remember it. These are my opinions. But it had to be this way with me or I wouldn't be standing here tonight. When I came into AA 19 years ago, alcoholism had just begun to be compared to diabetes. And in the 19 years that have followed, there has been a wealth of clinical evidence to establish that there is a definite correlation, a biochemical correlation between these two diseases. Both of them are progressive, and both of them are fatal, and both of them rest primarily on a biochemical change in the function of each individual. And I found myself on the night of July the 13th, 1952, in my apartment with a half-empty can of beer. It was a beverage I loathed, but it was part of my control drinking, asking myself a series of questions. Now, I had been drunk, suicidally drunk, for 2.5 months. I had been in and out of jail. I had made some jails I hadn't made before. I even made the Beverly Hills jail. That's not easy to do. And I'm more sanitariums than I'd ever been in all the time before. But on this particular night, these questions began to go through my mind. I found myself asking myself a question I had asked many times before, and that was, why is it, McGinnis, as often as you've tried to stay sober, and I will repeat that so that you'll, because the clue to what was wrong with my attitude toward drinking is hidden in this question. Why is it that as often in your life as you have tried with every fiber of sincerity in your being, not just to stay sober, do you hear that? Not just to stay sober, but to lead the kind of life that you know you're going to have to lead if you're ever going to know a moment's peace of mind, why is it that you've always failed? Now, I had asked myself that question many times before, and over the years I gave myself a lot of different answers. And I look back now, and there was a germ of truth in all of the answers. But that night, before any of the other answers could come, there was a new one came in. Still small voice that got into this drunken brain and said, the reason, McGinnis, you have always failed is because never, ever in your life have you ever been willing to stand still and let it hurt. You are the original no-pain guy. And it was the pattern of my entire life. Certainly it was the pattern of my drinking. I would stay sober until staying sober began to hurt more than I could stand it. And then I would switch. And then I would drink until I simply couldn't stand the pain, the sickness, the illness, the remorse, the degradation, and the humiliation any longer. And then would come the prayers and the oh my gods and I promise yous, and I would switch back. It was the pattern of the way I practiced my religion. I was always trying to be either the St. Francis of Wilshire Boulevard or the Nero of Sunset Boulevard. It was the way I followed my job. I would do your work, my work, our work, their work, and then I would go away for 2 weeks and nobody would find me. And so I said that night, well, if I'm a moral coward, what in the long run looks like it would be the easiest way out. And then I remembered two things that I had heard in this thing that I had been in for 3 months and which I really held in such contempt. I don't think I should say contempt, because contempt means, would imply that I had a great deal of feeling about it, and I really didn't have a great deal of feeling about AA the first 3 months that I was in it. I was just going through the motions, but I thought I was giving it the best shot I had, and I suppose at that time I was. But I remembered hearing that it is the first drink that gets you drunk. And I remembered my reaction when I heard this profound piece of wisdom. It was a reaction of rage that I had to come to this crazy, square, carny thing to find that out. Why, I couldn't have figured that out for myself. Because it was so obviously true that if I didn't take the first drink, neither God nor man could ever get me drunk. And then the second thing I remembered hearing very vaguely was that alcoholism is a disease of a progressive and fatal nature. Now, you know, as a matter of fact, I remember when I was in the sanitarium and Eddie Regan, my sponsor, came to see me again and again, and I was lying on the bed doing my usual mea culpas, you know. And he said, well, for God's sakes, Alan, quit giving yourself such a bad time. He said, after all, you have a disease. And I thought, wouldn't you know? I'm this drunk, I've caught something. And that was the last I thought I ever gave to a disease, because when I came into AA, they started talking immediately about being a better person. And that was something I tuned up to, because, you know, I had had this neurotic need for sanctity as far back as I could remember. So that night I thought to myself, well, suppose I had diabetes. And I'm with the doctor, the same doctor that first mentioned the word alcoholic to me. Would he say to me, look, McGinnis, if you want to be a better person, you will stay away from the first bite of sugar? Wouldn't he rather say, look, McGinnis, if you want to live, you'll stay away from the first bite of sugar, and you'll take your insulin? And so that, then, there only remained one $64,000 question for me to answer then. And that was, all right, McGinnis, do you really believe it is a progressive and fatal disease? Or are you just fooling around with this? All of these, I will stay sober ifs, and with everybody else that's saying the same thing all around you, people looking off at horizons only they can see, and saying, well, for me, sobriety alone is not enough. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. I like that, too. You know, it's true of me, too. I thought, do I really believe it? And then I thought, well, I'll try to look at the evidence. That night I began to play a game that I've played ever since. I call it look at the evidence. I thought, do I have any evidence in my own life that it is progressive? Well, you know the answer to that. I would have had to be a raving maniac to deny that it was progressive. It was so progressive, it was scaring the hell out of me. And then I moved on to that, and I thought, well, what about its being fatal? And I thought, well, I better not press that one too far. Autopsies seldom benefit the people upon whom they are performed. So I thought, well, it seems to me the whole answer to this thing lies in, do I believe I've got it? And do I believe it can kill me? And if the answer to that is yes, then it doesn't matter a damn whether it is a physical disease, a spiritual disease, an emotional disease, a mental disease, or a combination of all of that. The fact remains, I've got to buy whether or not I think it is a killer disease. And if the answer to that is yes, then comes the final question, and that is, would I rather live than die? And if the answer to that is yes, then you're finally up against it. You're up against, will I, can I stay away from the first drink? Can I stay away from the first drink? I had answered many, many times before, and so have all of you. We've all stayed away from the first drink for varying lengths of time. I stayed away once for a year and a half, but no trouble at all. So I knew I could stay away from the first drink. And then that night, somehow or other, it got all clear in my mind that this background that I had come into AA with, and the Catholics had no copyright on this. God, Muslims are coming in with the same thing, that if you stay sober, you should get something for it. And that was, if it's a disease, then let's take all of this other stuff away from it. And that night, my recovery from alcoholism began, because I did what I had never been able to do before, because I didn't know that that was what I needed to do. I separated the state of sobriety from the state of grace. And to me, in my background, they had always been completely and inextricably interdependent. I didn't stop there. I separated the state of sobriety from the state of my soul, from the state of my health, from the state of my finances, from the state of my job, from the state of my love life, if any. I separated it from the state of everything. I simply made up my mind that I would rather live than die. And if I had a disease, I would have to stay away from the first drink. And I knew that if I took all this other stuff off of it, if I took the be a better person business off of it, I would be able to do it. And that night I made a very simple decision. And I now know it was the first authentic 24-carat decision I had ever made in my life. Because the minute I made it, I knew I'd be able to do it. A man who had wept, prayed, cried, sweated, crawled in his efforts to stay stopped, because I stopped, good God, I stopped hundreds of times, but I couldn't stay stopped, knew he would be able to do it. And that's as far as I went. I had no fear of anything else. It was no longer anymore saying, oh my God, I promise you that I will not only stay sober, but also, as I had always done before, and follow it up with a list that would make the Virgin Mary blanch. I was doomed before I ever got started, because it had nothing to do with reality. It was due with neurotic fears. And from that moment of July the 13th, 1952, from that night until this night, ladies and gentlemen, I have never, ever had the slightest, not the slightest, desire nor need to take a drink. And if I can quickly sketch in the 19 years that follow, you will see that I needed that foundation. That unshakable foundation, to know that that escape route was sealed, that bridge was burned, that door was closed, and any other metaphor or simile you wish to employ. Now, I didn't know where to go with a simple decision, and I thought I should go somewhere with it, because it was momentous to me. I couldn't see myself walking back into the vaulted cathedrals of the Roman Catholic Church saying, hi, I'm going to stay away from the first drink. I just didn't think this was getting me much attention. So I went back to the place where they told me the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. And I thought, this time I'd go back and we play the game differently. They told me that my recovery demand depends upon rigorous honesty, so for at long last I'm going to put them to the test. I'm going to see if they can live with rigorous honesty, because I am no longer going to pretend. There will be no more half smiles. There will be no more running up to the speaker afterwards. When I've been sitting out there all the time, he's up there sweating blood and talking, I'm saying to myself, my God, why did he ever sober up? And then run up afterwards and shake his hand and say, thank you, you helped me. Oh my God, in the years that have followed, I wonder how many times I've been paid back in the same coin. I thought, I'll put them to the test. I'll find out just how they are, because they tell me there are no rules nor regulations, there are no sanctions, there are no directives, there is no dogma, there is no ritual. I can't be excommunicated as long as I stay away from the first drink, so we're going to find out. Now, there is a passage, as many of you know, in the Old Testament that says, the wicked are put upon the earth to exercise the just. And I think for the next 2 years, I was in AA to improve the sobriety of the members with whom I came in contact. And if any of you are doubtful about this, AA will live with it. AA will stick with it. Nobody ever told me to leave a meeting. They avoided me. I would find myself sitting alone an awful lot. But nobody ever said, Alan, you got to go. And when I'd been sober about a year and a half, I guess that power that's been running this for me all along decided that, well, we'll do what we always have to do with this one. We'll scare the living bejesus out of him. And I found out I was going to be transferred back to our New York office. I was going back to, with this advertising agency I was with, I was going back to play in the major leagues. And of course, as I had always done, came the bargain, you know. I need help. You know, I'm scared. So why don't I get with this? You know, so right away, for the first time, I took a written inventory. My other inventory, I never bothered with a written inventory because the fourth step meant going to confession to me. And I did that, like, in my sleep. So I went the whole bit. I did the written inventory, the fifth step, and I went off to New York, and I discovered the first big school in AA. It's very operative back there. Its motive is right out of the book, although they don't seem to, at least at those days, they didn't have nearly as much dependence upon or respect for the big book as we do out here. But their motive was, action is the magic word. It doesn't matter what you are doing, just as long as you are moving. And I moved. I was the secretary of two groups concurrently. When I got off work at 5 o'clock, I ran to the intergroup office and manned the phones there from 5 to 7, and then I went to a meeting. And as these two meetings that they had, both of these groups that I was secretary of concurrently had two meetings a week. And then 3 nights a week, I rushed up to Knickerbocker Hospital, where, as you know, at that time they had an AA ward, and I did my Florence Nightingale number up there. If I could have found a candle to carry around in my hand, I would have. And I remember every once in a while I would try to sit down, and some worthy AA old-timer who always assured you that his story was in the book would say, you're getting that look again, McGinnis. You look edgy. And I'd say, I'm just tired. But I kept going. I think I reached the ultimate in this school on a Christmas Eve in the Manhattan State Hospital for the Insane, where I emceed a Christmas party for 450 members of that institution. They were not alcoholics. They were just something for them to come to. They were all out there, 450 of them, in various stages of catatonic withdrawal, and I'm up on the stage singing Jingle Bells. How many of you have gone to those lengths to get it? Just about the time I was ready to collapse, my higher power moved into the scene again, and I was returned to Los Angeles as the copy chief of that office in this agency. And there I discovered something that seemed to have grown in my absence, the second largest school in AA activity. And they have a motto, too. It could be called Love Conquers All. The main requirement for membership in this school is that you are happy. You had better damn well be happy. Or you are banished to that limbo reserved for those who have stopped growing. Now you find certain meetings, they are known to the initiated. They're generally large meetings. Wall-to-wall love. It's every bit as large as this. And you have to get there early because there's a lot of kissing and handshaking that has to go on. Matter of fact, sometimes these meetings are so large in Southern California that it is impossible for one member to convey his love personally to another one. So you see them from one sitting over here and someone say, and love sweeps across the room. So I was a faithful devotee of this school until I almost died of it. By this time, I've been sober about 10 years, and I'm sure that I was being pointed out. I'm quite confident, and this never reached my ears, but I look back now, and I'm quite sure that I was being pointed out to people as an example of what sobriety can do for you. You know? Look at him. See how he's prospering? See how happy he is? He's got a job. He's making money. He's got a home. He's redesigned this hill that he... Oh, we'll get to that later. Everything was fine. Everything was fine. There was just one little thing that was wrong. I was coming apart. As a matter of fact, it came to a head with an obsessive hatred of my boss. I hated this man so badly that I couldn't sleep. I couldn't get him out of my mind. I don't know why I had a friend left, because all I would talk about is what a bastard this man was. And I did everything that anybody told me. I prayed for him. I would tell you people who follow the biblical injunction to pray for those who persecute you, to be sure you want your prayers answered. Because the more I prayed for this bastard, the more he prospered. God answered every prayer I ever sent up for him. He grew like the Green Bay tree while I went crazy. And so finally I made a big decision to do something that I had been really knew in my heart that I would have to give a try, although I was afraid to do it. And that is, I decided that I would go into analysis. As I stand here tonight, now I went into a classical Freudian analysis that's lasted 4.5 years, and in the past 2 years I have, in order to fit myself out for whatever life may hold for me in the matter of employment, I have very thoroughly engaged in and made a study of all the various other therapies that are springing up today, like McDonald's hamburger stands. So as you see me standing here before you tonight, I have been baptized, confirmed, analyzed, encountered, bioenergized, gestalted, and rolfed. So if you want to see me privately, I can tell you some astounding things. Now, of course, I guess all of it could be summed up in one sentence, which is more or less accurate, and that is that all of this activity is a case of the id being examined by the odd. But for me, it worked. It changed my whole attitude, something that I had never been able to do, and I guess since I believe now that God has ordered everything in my life, this must be where I had to go. At the risk of oversimplification, since this is part of the sharing, I'd touch briefly on what I found out about me, and I shouldn't even begin it, but I would be doing a disservice to you. As a matter of fact, I'd be really mean and cruel if I brought you up to this point and then said, you know, and this worked fine, and let it go at that. But you see, I had noticed in these years of sobriety that I performed according to a pattern that I repeated over and over and over again, no matter what I did. And I knew somehow or other that I would have to find out what was motivating me, what was making me react again and again and again the way I reacted. And as I said, at the risk of tremendous oversimplification, this is what I found out. I passed it along to you. It's tremendously brief, and maybe I shouldn't even go into it, but enough apology, I'll get on with it. I found out that, as everybody else is, I was a product of my heritage, my environment, and my culture, that it shaped and molded every action of my life, and that mainly I had been influenced by that unholy trinity of guilt and anger and fear, and that they had come about in that order. The guilt I'm talking about is not objective guilt. It is a subjective guilt, a feeling of unworthiness, a personal unworthiness, that I think can best be described to you in something my mother used to always say to me when I was a child, and which I echoes in my brain even yet, when Mom used to say to me, "Alan, be good or God won't love you." Do you hear it? It is theologically inaccurate. And my mother didn't know she was speaking heresy, but she was speaking what she had been taught. "Alan, be good or God won't love you." Now, this little tiny child now has been taught that he must perform. He must first perform, and then he wins God's love. Then he becomes worthy. And from there on, all of his worth, for as long as he lives, will be based upon his performance. Now, when you test this, and I can't, as I said, I can't go into it too far, this brings about, naturally, in the child, a sense of unbearable rage and anger, because he keeps failing. He keeps failing, and he can't figure out why he's failing. He tries and tries and tries. But always it's do it better, do it better, do it better. The unreal goals that had neurotically been passed on from generation to generation to generation is passed on to him. So the only thing he constantly achieves is failure. There is no such thing as good in his life. There is only better. And it took me a lifetime of pain and almost disaster to learn that in the constant pursuit of the better to which our culture is devoted, we constantly and consistently negate the present good. So there never is any good. It doesn't exist. There is only a better that is never attained. So there is never any accomplishment. There is never any peace. And finally, out of rebellion, you begin to make this guilt objective. Since you can't express your anger any other way, you express it in the only way you can, and that is to finally fail deliberately. And now you have objective guilt, which brings on fear. And the two main fears that motivated me all of my life, motivated everything that I ever did, was the fear of punishment and the fear of exposure. I remember very clearly, at quite a very early age, when your world is made up of things like that, I remember how very clearly I divided the whole human race into two groups. There were those who hated me, and those who didn't like me. And when you are surrounded with enemies like that, you had better come up with a survival kit that will work. And I came up with a survival kit that all good, red-blooded, first-class, dues-paying neurotics come up with. We come up with them because it's the techniques that are taught us in our culture. I played two games simultaneously. The first game was, if I can make them love me, then they won't hurt me. But something tells you, since you've always failed, that you never will get everybody to love you, because that's what this love has to be, since it's going to be earned. It has to be instantaneous and universal. There must be no dissent. And so you hedge your bets by playing another game that could have as its motto, if I am stronger than they are, then they can't hurt me. And, of course, it never occurs to the good, blossoming, flourishing neurotic that he is constantly canceling these two things out. As a matter of fact, I remember somewhere in my analysis, I suddenly sat up from the couch and said, "I see it." He says, "You see what?" I said, "I think I see what a neurotic is." And he says, "What is a neurotic?" I says, "A neurotic is a person who is trying simply to stand still. That's all he wants to do. He just wants to stand still. And he tries to stand still by going in exactly opposite directions at the same time." And he said, "Mr. McGinnis, there have been tomes written that have never described a neurotic better." He says, "May I use that?" I said, "Feel free." And you serve two tyrants. There is no more insatiable tyrants than the need for approval, admiration, love, recognition, status. It's a bottomless pit. There's never any bottom. There's never any, there's no way to satiate this monster. As a matter of fact, I stayed awake most of last night trying to satiate it. The need, the wondering how I would do tonight. The need, I made, I don't know, 15 different magnificent pictures last night lying awake in bed. And of course, since unfortunately no one was in bed with me, they are lost to posterity. But I also used the other technique, and that is, I searched for your Achilles heel. Only God knows how, in the service of this tyranny, this need for approval, how many asses we will kiss, how many people we will flatter, how many lies we will tell, how many people we will fawn upon. Generally, they are people who have something that we want. And then, to hedge it, search for their Achilles heel. So that if all the time you're winning them over, you are cutting them down to size. The need to dominate, the need to excel, the need to compete, the need to be number one. Again, right out of our culture. Oh, we live in a democracy where we say anybody can be president. Of course, today I think it's true. But what we're really saying is everybody should be president. Maybe to some more sane people, this sounds like an activity that would be difficult to achieve. But if you are a good red-blooded neurotic, as I am, you know it's not difficult at all. These two contradictory techniques come very naturally to you, and you develop all kinds of games to implement them. It was so simple for me. I was forever jumping up in your lap to be petted. And if you didn't pet me, I jumped off your lap and I bit you. It was as simple as that. And finally, when this saw the knowledge, I've got to get off this or we're not going to end up here tonight. I found out I had to let go of the, again, as it says in the book, let go of the old ideas, let go of the techniques, that this survival kit, that, you see, for a long time works. It works until it turns into a self-destruct kit. And then it's killing you. It's killing you because it can't work indefinitely. It can't work. And to substitute for the self-destruct games, constructive games. And I did pretty well. I had everything in my life changed. My attitude, my relations at the office, I quit competing. It's hard to do, but I did it. Especially in a business that I think next to show business is probably the most knife in the back, competitive, pressure-ridden business that you can get into. Although it seems to me that every business is really that way in our culture. And then this brings me to the October of 1967. I was just back from my first trip to Europe. I had had two or three of the happiest years of my life. I think years in which I was probably more effective, more constructive than I'd ever been in my life. When I was called in and told by my management that the time had come for me to go home, I was going to be what, to use a euphemism, retired. That's the word they use today. After a certain amount of gray comes in your hair in the business I'm in, and it's coming earlier and earlier and earlier in our youth-oriented culture. Somebody asked me the other day, Alan, do you resent the young? I said, no, I don't resent the young at all. And they said, why? I said, all I have to do is wait. Their time is coming. And as we do in this particular company that I work for, they give you a great stage facing. You are given going away. I was given a going away reception and a banquet and gifts. And also I left because I owned stock and I had a severance agreement and profit sharing. That's the other way they save face. I left. And of course, these terms are all relative. To some, to describe my material gain at this point in my life, the phrase might have been, well, he's comfortably well off. To me, from the background that I came from, I was filthy rich. And so I thought, I knew that my ego had been really socked, because I felt, my God, my contribution, my days of contributing are over. But I've got a lot of money, and it can do me the rest of my life. And so the publicity releases were made to the trades. I had meetings with the clients. This McGinnis is going to leave to travel and write. And I left. And for this 1968, I gave myself as kind of a sabbatical. I had been working. I never went to college. I came out of school in the depths of the Depression. I went to work at the age of 15 and took care of my mother and my father until I went into the Army, paying off the debts of a father who had lost all of his money and was too proud to take bankruptcy. And I'll try to tie that in very quickly to what happened. In 1969, in the rains in California at that time, I had a series of landslides at this home. And in the meantime, the retirement capital that I had, I hate to go through all of this, but it has to be told, or else I don't end up where I should end up. I can't tell you, ladies and gentlemen, how much I should like to skip all of this. But I would not be sharing with you if I did. And I'm sorely tempted to try to do it even now. Anyway, after being what I thought was very, very cautious and very, very sound and very, very practical, I put my entire retirement capital in the hands of two investment counselors. And found out later on, some months later, that they had placed this capital. See, I thought I was being smart by dividing it up between two of them. Only to find out that both of them had put me entirely in the stock market, in highly speculative issues, and on margin. As most of you know, all during 1969 and 1970, the bear market was with us. And while I was trying to spend thousands of dollars to get this house back in shape where I could put it on the market and sell it, then the margin calls began to come. That's when I found out what margin was. And I kept trying to come up with more collateral. And finally, I was being sold out in order to pay off these debts. And to make a long story short, for the first time in my life, I found myself bit by bit by bit by bit going into what I didn't know, but what I was later to find out was an acute suicidal depression. There may be some of you in this room. I'm sure there are. As a matter of fact, there have been, I know one or two, and another lady came up and told me that she was at Bakersfield last year on October the 25th when I decided that I would go ahead with a commitment that I had made to speak there. And I don't remember much about that. Mercifully, God has blurred a lot of it in my mind. All I know is that I tried to do there that day what I'm trying to do here tonight, and that is fulfill what I believe AA has, the only thing AA has ever asked of me, and that is to be rigorously honest and to share with you what is going on with me. But I went ahead with the commitment that I had decided to go ahead, and I could have, in all truth and in all honesty, said that I was too ill, because I was too ill to go ahead with it, but I decided that I would go ahead with it. And all I know is that if some of you were there that day, you saw AA in action. You saw a man standing up on the podium, not giving, but receiving. You saw waves of compassion, love, concern, support, prayer, what have you. You saw, in my opinion, God as we understand him at work. And it would be wonderful if I could tell you that I left that stage that day and everything was fine. But I didn't. I left there and it got steadily worse. And I went about making plans to die. It was no longer a question. I never once, as I said, entered my mind to drink or take pills. But I had been going to doctors. And they were always giving me prescriptions for tranquilizers. And I would come home, I'd get them filled, come home, put them in the medicine chest. Oh, I had a beautiful selection. They were green and black ones and orange ones and white ones. It looked like a rainbow. And I was going to find the pot at the end of the rainbow. I revised my will. I got rid of a lot of books and things like that that I could dispose of. And I realized that it was no longer a question in my mind of if I was going to die, which is how I was going to do it. And I decided that the tranquilizers would be the best route And on the morning of November the 14th, 1970, last year, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I decided I just simply couldn't go on any longer. I couldn't face anything any longer, and I took a big handful of the tranquilizers, and I put them in my mouth. Now, only God knows why I didn't swallow them. All I know is I couldn't. Whether it was Catholicism, AA, you, prayers, the prayers of people that have gone on the prayer, I don't know. All I know is I took them out of my mouth. I couldn't swallow them. And when I had them sitting, looking at them in my hand, the door opened, and a friend that my doctor had gotten in touch with, because he had seen me the day before, walked through the door, and he said, "Dr. Friedman has begged me to come and take you to the hospital." And I said, "All right, I'll go. I don't think it will do me any good, but I don't want to go on living, and I can't die. So I guess once again, I'll have to throw in the towel and say, I would rather live than die." And I went into the psychiatric ward of Mount Sinai Hospital, and I left there 26 days later after having 6 shock treatments that reversed the depression, and I came out knowing that I would be able to make it. On the last day of the year, I went into escrow on the sale of the house. That, again, is another miracle. There was absolutely no loan company in that part of the state that would touch that house. The assessment on it had been doubled. The property taxes had tripled. And not one person would loan on it. Not a bank, not a mortgage company, not anybody. And yet, the man that wanted to buy it came by. The one buyer that fell in love with the place finally managed to come up with enough money that I ended up taking an actual $16,000 cash equity loss on it. But he wanted it, and I wanted out. It was sold. I moved into an apartment in Encino, and I've started putting my life back together again. Now, that's the experience. But what do I have to share with you? I mean, it would have been awful to go through that and then now end and say, "Well, okay, kids, I came through and I didn't drink, and fine and dandy, I didn't, and I'm grateful to God." But now I'll try to tell you as in what time I have left here, what to pass along to you, what gets clearer in my mind every day. In the first place, I think I know, always before when I'd been in AA, all these years that I'd worked with other people and they told me about depressions, I would think, yes, I've had depressions, but I never had a depression. I didn't have a depression at all. A depression, I believe, is mass anger turned in upon yourself. It has nothing at all to do with self-pity. Self-pity is not nearly as destructive or as dangerous. Corrosive as it is, I really believe now, because you see, in self-pity, it's always somebody else's fault. It's not yours. In a depression, suicidal depression that I went into, it was my fault. I had done it. I paced back and forth. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. It was back and forth. My goodness, you had it made and you blew it. You had it made and you blew it. And again, the thing that had been with me all these years from my childhood that I didn't know about was the complete and total inability to forgive myself. Complete, total inability to forgive myself. You see, the only reason I was able to accept alcoholism was when I found out it wasn't my fault, that it was a disease, and I could accept it. And also, I think it entails a loss, a sense of loss. That's why so many people go into depression, suicidal depressions, when they have lost a child or a spouse or a relative. With me, you lose part. In any case, you're always losing part of yourself, something that is you. And you see, this is what I learned, that despite all that I thought I had accomplished, all that I had learned, God had to teach me the ultimate lesson. And that was that my self-esteem, just exactly the way I had learned it in this competitive and materialistic culture of ours, my self-esteem was made up of what I had, what I possessed, what I had in the bank, what I had to show for it, the status I had achieved, my job, my sense of being somebody. And when that begins to go, when your self-esteem is made up of money, property, prestige, and they begin to go, then you begin to go with it. Your self-esteem, everything that you think you are, begins to go with it, and life is no longer worth living. You see, when I lost my job at this agency, right then I lost the prestige and the status, but I had the money that saved my face. And when that began to go, then the rest of the self-esteem went with it, and life was no longer living. A man who had been miraculously given his life 18 years before no longer wanted it. It's rather painful to admit, but that's the way it is. And what I would conjure any of you to think about is you too are products of this culture. And we talk a lot about it. You see, we think all of these years of the sobriety went by, I thought I had learned. Our society today is filled with people running around saying, I want to know who I am. I want to know who I am. I want to know who I am. And then when you try to introduce them to who they are, they run screaming in the other direction. But I believe that the answer to who I am, who am I, is very, very simple. We are all the same who. We are human beings. And as human beings, we are heir to all the strengths as well as all the weaknesses, all the faults as well as all the assets, all the virtues as well as all the vices of every other human being. What I now know is important is not who I am, but what I am. Because when the chips are down, I am what I believe. I am where my values are and what I am willing to do about it. What I believe and what I am willing to do about it. Some months ago, I found myself on my knees crying out into the darkness of this bleak desolation that I found myself in, a prayer that I had never uttered before in my life. It was a very simple prayer from one who is wont to make very elaborate prayers. But this one said, please God, let me come home from the wars. And I realized that the operative word in that prayer, as far as I know, I have never read that anywhere. As far as I know, it came out of a heart filled with despair and anguish and self-reproach and self-hatred. But I knew the minute I heard it that the key word was home. Home. It was coming out of a guy who had never, ever in his life felt at home. I remember when I was a young man and I loved to go to concerts and save my pennies for concerts, the baritones of my day, John Charles Thomas and Nelson Eddy and people like that, were wont to sing for an encore a corny song I loved. It was called The Hills of Home, and it tore at my heart every time I heard it. And I remember the verse that said, all things come home at eventide. Like birds that weary of their roaming. And I would hasten to your side, homing. And I knew that I had never felt at home. I had never felt at home in my home. I had never felt at home in my religion. And for many years, I had not felt at home even in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember how I had thought and how I had planned. And someday I'll have a home, and it will be mine. And the rain will be gentle on its roof, and the wind will touch it kindly. But you see, I had to learn that a home is not stone and mortar and roof. A home is where the heart finds rest and renewal. That's where coming home is. I am far enough along in the journey now to be able to see that there is only one ultimate coming home, and that is the final, total, complete surrender of self to a power greater than myself. And I'm also brave enough today to believe that there will come a day, there will be a place sometime, somewhere, someday. There will be an altar or a confessional, a mountain or a valley, probably, in all likelihood, just a plain, everyday, run-of-the-mill AA meeting where I will finally no longer pull back and say, oh my God, no, no, don't ask that of me. Don't take that away from me too. And when that moment comes, then I know that I will finally have come home. In the meantime, I am more at home here than anywhere I have ever been in my life. And I'm more at home here for a very simple reason. You have never, ever asked anything of me. And so therefore, I have been able to give you what I could afford. And what I'm trying to do tonight is to tell you that I have made, as T.S. Eliot said, I have made, as he once said, there will never be any end. We will never cease from exploring. And the end of all our exploration will be to return to the place where we started and to see it for the first time. And that is why I tell you, it took something that almost killed me to return me finally to the place where I started, to see it for the first time, and to return to you tonight and tell you that this journey has been worth everything I have been asked to pay to make it. There are probably not more than five or six of you in this room tonight that I know by name, but you are counterparts of other faces and other hearts that I do know by name in other rooms like this. And so I know you will understand when I tell you here tonight, quite simply, that I quite literally owe you my life. I quite literally owe you my sanity. And all I have tried to do here tonight is to pay you a little interest on that debt. I beg your prayers and your love, and for whatever they may be worth, I give you mine.